last year was not a year of war and was not a year of peace. It was not a bountiful year. It was also not a year of want. The year reminded me of our Cleveland weather. Generally overcast, frequently dreary, and always changeable. And as we look ahead to the next year, the prospect is really for more of the same. There's really no reason to believe that the new year, the year 5737 according to our ancient calendar, the new year will be any different, any freer of problems than the last. Inflation and the energy crisis and pollution will not simply fade away, disappear. No reason to believe that the bloodshed in Ireland or in the Lebanon or in South Africa will diminish. Even if it does, there is undoubtedly be bloodshed and gunfire elsewhere. And over it all, there's the terrifying shadow of racial hate, of Arab jihad, and of the bitter frustrations of the third world. The Cleveland weather, particularly the Cleveland winter, drives many of you south for the winter. I suspect that there are many in our world who would like to go south. Perhaps all of our world would like to go south. But obviously that can't be. We are history. We can't escape it. And recognizing this, the common sense of mankind has been reasserting itself. There's been a new squaring of the chin, a new determination, a new resignation. We'll carry on somehow. We'll make do. We've resurrected a grave verb from our ancient vocabulary. The verb is to cope. Used to be when we asked someone, how are you doing? He'd say fine, or all right, or okay. But now the answer is, well, I'm coping. And this word coping is an interesting one. It's from the same root as the French coupé, to cut. It comes from an old English, old French noun, coupen, which means, or which described rather, a duel. A long, protracted, exhausting, bloody duel in which neither knight could gain the upper hand. It was this kind of endless, exhausting, debilitating struggle without any relief, without any real hope of victory. And as the year has progressed, I have sensed a growing spirit of resignation, determination and of resignation. The gray verbs have come back into popularity. And though it is obviously commendable to square the chin and roll up the sleeves and determine, well, I can't go south for the winter, so I'll hunker down and button up and put on my boots and plod out there as best I can. So obviously this is a commendable virtue. It isn't a very joyous one. It seems to offer us little prospect of happiness. I wonder how many of us really are eager for the new year. Last week in our library, I picked up an Anglo-Jewish journal and I noticed the editorial about the new year. It bore the headline, 5737, Can We Cope? And the journalist proceeded to list all of the problems which beset the Jewish people in Israel. The first paragraph was about Soviet anti-Semitism and the staunching of the limiting of immigration. There was a paragraph about the growing violence of neo-Nazism in the Argentine. There was a paragraph about the inevitable dislocations which face the Jewish community of the Union of South Africa, the Jewish community of Rhodesia. There's a paragraph about the worldwide economic effects of the Arab boycott. There was a paragraph about the high cost of Israel's defense and the stresses that this was placing upon the Israeli economy. There was a paragraph about international terrorism, piracy. There was a paragraph about the vulgarity of the debates and actions of the United Nations, controlled as it is by the coterie of the Third World and the Arab League. There was a paragraph about the sale of American supersonic jets and air-to-ground missiles to the Gulf states, the Arab states of the Gulf, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and on and on. And in the last paragraph, the journalist turned his attention to the next year, and he asked his question, can we hope? And the answer obviously was yes. He intends to publish next year. He wants you to take out a subscription. Can we cope? Yes. And then the inevitable unspoken question, well, how? He really had no other answer but the old piety, Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel lives. We have survived, therefore we will survive. And that was the end. Now, I have no argument with this long litany of problems which face the Jewish people in Israel. They're all factual, they're all true, and I could add a few of my own. And I'm perfectly convinced that the people of Israel, the Jewish communities of the world, will survive. But I wonder if we have only that kind of joyless and burdensome prospect. I kept wondering as I read this article how his great-grandfather might have written it. How this article would have sounded if it had not been written by a comfortable journalist in London, but by his great-grandfather, who, let's assume, was an emigrant from Tsarist Russia who came out after Kishinev and went to the east side of London and was trying to make do in some blue-collar way. Would he have emphasized and been surprised by Soviet anti-Semitism? Or would he have been surprised by the citizenship of the Jews in all of the countries of the free world, by our remarkable progress, by our remarkable prosperity, by the incredible rights that we enjoy, the rights of all citizens? And I wonder if his great-grandfather would have been so concerned with the high cost of Israel's defense, or he would not have been amazed by the very existence of the State of Israel. After 1900 years of homelessness, the Jewish people now were in their home, and they've been able to defend that home through four wars for nearly three decades. Would that have not been the emphasis, the positive, the accomplishment? And I wondered if he would have chosen to talk about the sale of some arms by the United States to the Gulf states, or we would have spoken of three or four decades of remarkable support, military and political support, by the greatest power of the world, of a Jewish state far away from its borders. Paradoxically, so many of the problems which disturb us, which make many of us downcast, which seem to cause us to be fearful of tomorrow, are a product of the remarkable accomplishments of the last decades, of the last generations. We expect what our grandparents could hardly dream of. And when there's the least little ruffle, the least little ripple of problem, we become despondent. And when some very real problems face us, we often want to run away from them, to go south for the winter. And what's true of our Jewish community, the very special set of problems which face us as Jews, is equally true of the larger community and of its own mood. I watched, as many of you did, the great debate last night. And I thought about our elections. And I thought about the comment which so many observers have made that most of the American people, or at least the majority of Americans, seem relatively disinterested in this election, that many will not vote and most seem not to be following the issues and very few seem to be excited about one party or the other, one candidate or the other. and began to wonder why. And I've heard many reasons. Some speak of Watergate, of disenchantment with all politicians, the feeling that all politicians are self-serving and most of them are venal. And I found myself of charisma. The fact we may simply have two presidential candidates who lack that special magic, that special chemistry which communicates itself to people and brings out loyal followers and disciples. I thought of some of the professorial reasons that are given, the long-term disillusion of the power of the parties, of our unwillingness now to identify ourselves from cradle to the grave with one party or the other. And I'm sure that there's truth in all of these observations and in many others that might be made. But more and more I'm convinced that there's a truth which underlies all of these. And that is the simple truth that people will not follow a leader who doesn't know where he's going. That most of us have lost any faith that our leaders, however wise, however honest, really have answers to the problems that face us. Most of us know, deep down, that we're at one of those rough patches in history where there seem to be no answers. No one knows, for instance, really how to integrate a northern school system without white flight. And no one really knows how to guarantee a complicated economy, full employment, and yet limit inflation. And no one really knows how to achieve détente in a world where the great powers insist on military and imperial and economic imperialism. And none of us really know how to stretch the food supply of the world so that we can provide enough for the population explosion which is occurring within the world. And there are no answers to the question, how is it that after we bring the underprivileged and the undernourished and the underprovided for into the mainstream, into opportunity, how do we provide sufficiency for the ever-escalating appetites and desires which they will inevitably manifest? We're in one of those times where there seem to be no simple answers, no clear answers. And I would submit that one of the reasons that few seem to be excited by this election is that we recognize this fact, that it really doesn't seem to make much difference, because it's not a question of one man or one party with answers and one without, but that both of them are at this point stumbling along, trying one thing or another, seeking for answers, none of them with the answers at hand. And when suddenly, as I watched the television last night and the sound went off, I had a symbol of all that I'm saying. Here was the most powerful man in the world, and the only other man in the world who may hold that office, absolutely paralyzed by machinery, by the complexities of modern life. Here, these two powerful men could do nothing for 25 or 30 minutes but to stand square-jawed, determined, and impotent. We had been beaten by our machines. They had no answer. They couldn't fix it. And that's part of the reality of the moment. There are many problems out there that simply can't be fixed. We're no longer in a what we used to call a can-do situation, where every employer assumed that his employees could do, could achieve. We can try. We must try. There are no guarantees. There are many problems which we must admit have no solution. So we try to cope. We speak of trade-offs rather than of progress. We know that there's a social cost involved in every plan or program which we undertake. And what's true of our Jewish life, and is true of our national life, is equally true of our private life. The other day I went into a bookstore, and had a table with all of the best-selling non-fiction. And what was on that table of bestsellers? An infinite number of books on how to cope. How to cope with your marriage. How to cope with your divorce. How to cope with your children. How to cope with youth. How to cope with age. How to cope with your work. There was even a book on how to cope with your leisure. And as I looked at this vast array of volumes telling us of how to cope with our problems, I wondered if we're really such a burdened society. Was society so evil, so bad? Obviously not. And yet, obviously, many of us are frustrated and most of us seem unfulfilled. That was the word I noticed in all those jackets, those book jackets. This is the way to fulfillment. Absolute happiness, absolute joy at all times. Now, why are we frustrated? Why do we look at the futures and see only the burdens? Is it perhaps that we've had so much given to us? Science and technology and the generations that have come before have made so much opportunity for us that our expectations are so high that they're beyond realization. I had a woman come into my office the other day absolutely desolate because life was at an end, she told me. Really couldn't afford to go to Florida for the winter. Now, given the sense of heaviness of the spirit, delighted when there are at least those who are trying to cope, carry on. But what disturbs me is you carry on only so long, and then the joylessness of it all begins to weigh you down. You begin to pull away from the community and pull away from your responsibilities as a citizen and turn in on those which are only your own. There seems to me a growing sense of stoic resignation out there among us. Some of us are telling the others, well, if we don't have such high expectations, at least we won't have such profound depressions. If we don't want too much, we won't be too frustrated. So let's not want. The Greeks had a word, ascesis, which described a situation in which a man pulled himself back and disciplined his appetites and his desires and said, I can live really with almost nothing. I'll take whatever comes. I'm not going to allow myself to care or allow myself to love or allow myself to want because I'll be frustrated. I won't be able to fulfill, to gain those things which I desire. But I have that sense out among us. And yet here we are in Rosh Hashanah. As we came in those doors back there, we turned to each other and we said, L'shana Tova, may you have a good year. And obviously we weren't wishing each other just a year in which we'd managed to cope. A year where we drag ourselves along from problem to problem, from duty to duty. We were thinking of joy and of happiness and of love and of encouragement. We were anticipating, hoping that we could anticipate a good year for our friends. Tonight in the liturgy we said, Avinu Malkeinu Chadesh Aleinu Shana Tova. Our Father, our King, grant unto us a year of happiness. Renew our days. Fill them with spirit. And we weren't thinking simply of somehow managing, coping. We were thinking of obviously something far better. So the question that I'd like to raise with you this evening is this. How given our worlds it really is? The fact that the headlines will be as fearsome in their own way. Next year is this year. That our world will be as unsettled and as problem-filled next year as this year. How is it that we can find a measure of real joy, real happiness, the days that lie before us? Where does joy lie? And what I would suggest to you this evening is that joy can begin when most of us can begin to accept life for what it is. When we can begin to accept the fact that life is change and flux and growth and aging, that it is a short passage between the dependency of infancy and the dependency of age, that there is no finality to life, that life doesn't have conclusions, but all it has is our moments, experiences, the now. As I look back over the great hopes of mankind, I'm struck by the fact that most of them aim towards some conclusion. They assume that there's going to be an end of days when every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree and none shall make him afraid. They assume that there's going to be some time out there when everything is going to be right and secure now and forevermore, peace without end. And that's simply not the way of life. I suspect most of us have any kind of image in our minds of history, of life, we think of history as a kind of long climb from the cave to civilization. It's been a rough climb and a difficult climb, but most of us assume that someday we're going to reach the top and there'll be a grassy meadow there, which will be level and flat, paradise, if you will, utopia. But the Greeks said it 2,000 and more years ago when they created the word utopia, utopos, no place. There's no grassy plateau at the top. There's only the climb. And as long as there's human life on Earth, we'll be on that climb. And if we solve one set of problems, we're simply going to find ourselves facing another set of problems. It's true of your individual lives. Does any one of us ever reach a point where we can say, I have it now, everything I want, and I can keep it this way? I have my success, I have my profession, I have my skills, I have my family, I have my health, and I can hold on to it? Who of us can guarantee himself against illness or the uncertain politics of the world or sudden accidents? Who of us can guarantee the relationships within our family against stress, tension, separation? There's no point in our lives at which we can say, now I've had it made and I can keep it this way. I have my talents today, but for how many years will God give me the health to control them? And what's true of us individually is true of our world, of us when we look at ourselves collectively. There's never going to be a period of peace without end. There's never going to be a period without problems. Human beings inhabit the world. We're not saints. There are going to be problems. We're mortal. There's going to be death. There's going to be illness. There's going to be need. There's going to be appetite. There's going to be greed. There are those of us who have a degree of cruelty within us. The world will never be calm, endlessly secure. Most of the dreams of mankind involve the arrival at some point of ultimate security. In the beginning, man dreamt of supernatural intervention. The gods would bring paradise on earth, or man into paradise. God would give our people a Messiah, a son, Elijah, sign of the house of David, who would come down to us and bring freedom to Jerusalem, security to our world. For centuries, we prayed for the coming of that Messiah whose power would be supernatural, magical, somehow. By his coming, peace, freedom, and justice would come into our world. The dream of a Messiah was a hope which was understandable in an age where there was little change, little sense of that man could, in fact, affect history. Men used the same tools as their grandfathers. They lived in the same place. They farmed the same land. They used the same rudimentary medicines. They paid the same taxes to the same kind of tyrants. There was no change. There was no sense that life, in fact, could be changed by man. It needed to be changed by God.
therefore the hope invested in the Messiah. But the Messiah never came. And as the hope in the Messiah ever delayed began to grow thinner and thinner, when men, the Jewish people, were disrupted time and again by the pathetic desire to follow the so-called false messiahs, suddenly came upon a moment in history where we began to gain on knowledge, on ignorance, where the rate of knowledge, of learning, of invention, of discovery began to increase at a fairly rapid pace. About 300 years ago, we suddenly discovered ways in which to free man from the burden of being a beast of burden. We now had machines. We found ways to begin to draw life out, to destroy the dangers of childbirth, to begin to think of a lifespan not of 30 years or 40 years, but of 70 and 80 years and even more. We began to transform our world through our machines and our technology and our medicine, and a new hope came into being. Again, a hope with a definite goal, a definite time when there would be a conclusion. It was called the Messianic Age. No supernatural Messiah, but now a Messianic Age. You and I, or rather our grandparents, would somehow band together with all people of goodwill. And by our knowledge and our research, through our laboratories and our libraries, we would create a world of calmness and security and plenty, prosperity and full opportunity. And that world sustained many during the 19th and the early 20th century. But then came the pointless carnage of the First World War. Then came Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin. And then came those frightening machines which could give us energy but could also destroy the human race. And then we suddenly came upon the period in which we're now in, when our machines became not only friend but enemy, when our machines could master us and paralyze us as they did last night. We suddenly came upon a time when we recognized that medicine, by prolonging life, was also increasing the number of those in the world who could not be fed. That we had a new problem, a new bomb, a population bomb. And we found that for all of our productivity, providing things for people, was simply raping the world of its natural resource and destroying the energy resource of the world. We came into the period in which we are now, where we no longer really believe in a messianic age, in a moment out there when somehow we'll have reached it. Now, there are some who still believe the Marxist dream of a moment in time when suddenly all will become light and all will become final and clear, a conclusion. But most of us do not share that dream. But we can't believe in a personal Messiah. We can't believe in a messianic age. What then can we believe in? What then can give us hope and give us joy? The theme that I'd like to suggest to you tonight is the theme of the messianic journey. But it is possible, in a world of change, in a world without conclusions, it is possible to live a life which commits you to high ideals, great values. And in the very living of that life, there is joy. There is happiness. There's joy, is there not, in the work that we do that is worth the doing? And there's joy, is it not, in love and in family, and the ties of friendship when they're worth having? And there's joy, is it not, in when we give ourselves over to experiences which are significant to us, which touch our soul and inspire us and encourage us. There are moments of joy. If we do not hitch our hopes to some conclusion, fame, wealth, fortune, power, the achievement of certain goals, we may never get there. Moses never reached the promised land, and we may never even be able to leave Egypt. But wherever we are, whatever be our condition in life, possible, is it not, to expend our energies usefully and knowing that to find a certain satisfaction within ourselves, to seize on the moments of friendship and of love, when we rejoice in music and in art, when we express ourselves flowingly in words or in themes, it is possible, is there not, to find the moments which give us
true fulfillment, provided we know ourselves to be on the messianic journey, on the way, part of the pilgrimage of mankind towards the solution of the problems which face us. The children of Israel in the wilderness, none of us will ever reach the promised land. But there's a joy in being of the band numbered among those who are trying. I remember meeting a man some years ago who had been working for 15 years on a research project in physics. He'd never been able to solve the problem. As we talked, he was on a plane, I don't remember where we were flying to. I said to him, aren't you frustrated? You must be terribly disappointed by not having come to a conclusion. He said, I thought I would be, and there are times when I am, but you know, every lead that I've tracked down will save other people from going along that road to a dead end. I've helped. I'm not going to have the Nobel Prize, but I've helped. I've done something. I enjoyed going every morning to the laboratory. There was an excitement to what I was doing. I knew it was worth the doing. We don't have to succeed, because really there's no such thing as success. All there is the moment. And if we know pattern of our life good. We're among those who are building civilization. And if we take the time along the way to savor the way, savor each day, each relationship, our work has meaning. We have closeness and intimacy with those about us. Surely there's joy to the day. Surely we're on that messianic journey, which is a journey I would suggest. It can give pleasure, joy, happiness to the new year. Shana Tova Tikatevu. May each and every one of you rejoice in the messianic journey this coming year. Amen.